You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Monday Wire. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Danielle. Eka e whai aki nei coming up on the show today. For our regular catch-up, I talk to ex-Karen Chua about the Disability Access Bill and claims of heightened crime in cyclone-affected Hawke's Bay and Tairāwhiti. For tomorrow's world, Stella Huggins and Isla Christensen chat with environmental scientist Elliot Stevens about the future direction of slash and catchment management following Cyclone Gabrielle. Hannah Thompson speaks to Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp about the party's kaupapa, their absence from an election debate being held at the University of Auckland, and Te Matatini. I'll also be joined in the studio by Rhys Callan Turnbull to discuss whether young voters will turn out for the 2023 election. And Danielle, what have you got prepared for us today?
Yeah, I spoke with James Wellesley, and he argues that New Zealand is in a cycle of crisis concerning the arts and culture, and he explains how we can get out of that crisis.
E he aha o whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text us on 5395, or Wire Mai Rane, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oa e wariwari I ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anō he pakihiri roki roki mā runga, I tī pai, tuku tuku o erirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. Catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chua.
This week I spoke to ex-Karen Chua about a 14,500 strong petition to amend disability accessibility legislation that was delivered to Parliament this last week, and claims of increased crime in cyclone-affected Hawke's Bay and Tairāwhiti. Here is that interview. Last week, a 14,500-strong petition to amend disability accessibility legislation was delivered to Parliament, and yourself and disability advocates have described the current bill going through Parliament as toothless. So can you tell us what is this bill proposing and why you think it wouldn't achieve its purpose of making Aotearoa more accessible?
Yeah, so I'm actually not the disability spokesperson, but I sit on the select committee and I've listened to some of the submissions that have come through from the disability sector. It just seems like the Oranga Tamariki Oversight Bill all over again. We've got these proposals that just don't seem to have any teeth. So they'll have ideas and they'll say they'll produce a new committee, and then that committee will then go on to come up with ideas for access for the disabled community, and then they may pass on those ideas to the ministry. But there's no actual accountability for anything to happen after that. Nothing has any certainty. All the disabled community want is to be able to live their life to the best that they can with the same access as everybody else in this country takes for granted. And this bill just seems like a bit of a slap in the face to them. It's been going on for many, many years now, and all we can come up with is creating a new committee.
What changes would the ACT Party support being made to the legislation?
Yeah, so, I mean, as I said, I'm not the disability spokesperson. All I can speak to is what I've been hearing, and the disability community is saying that this is just not good enough. Their voices haven't been listened to, and it actually won't make a difference in their lives. And there are certain things that I think are valid. They're talking about they want access to education, just like every other young person is entitled to in this country. And if a school or if a government organisation is limiting or creating barriers to their education, then that should be looked into, and those schools should have a stern talking to, and it should be turned around for them.
And the next topic I wanted to talk about is the ACT Party's criticism of the government and police's response to managing crime in Te Rāwhiti and the Hawke's Bay. Can you explain your party's concerns for the region?
Yeah, so our party leader, David Seymour, was down there speaking to some of the people that have been affected by this disaster. And the feeling of unease and the feeling of not being safe was very loud and clear when he went to visit. And the government downplaying the crime is not helping these people. And we called for military to go in and give the police a hand, just to be visible and present in the community, to give those people just a little bit more sense of security as they're dealing with what's going on around them.
The police and local authorities have rejected a lot of the claims of heightened crime in the regions, and that reports of crime are being exaggerated and being used as a political football. And Chris Hipkins has also said that there's no state of lawlessness in the Hawke's Bay following the cyclones. How would you respond to this?
Yeah, crime is crime, right? And we're hearing that family harm incidences have gone up by about 60% down there. And that is a crime. And that shows that there is a need for more patrols, there is a need for more support, there is a need for people to be out there and be visible. It's not necessarily around particular crimes. It's around making the community feel safe and secure. This is a time where people are so anxious and they just need that certainty that everything's going to be okay. When you've got no access to phone lines, internet, or to be able to report these incidences to the police, I'm not quite sure if telling them that this isn't happening is helpful also.
So the police have recognised the 60% increase in incidents of family harm in the region, but they're denying any claims of an increase in theft and burglary. So I guess my question would be, do you believe them?
Well, I haven't actually spoken to anybody personally, but I do know David has been down there and has spoken to people who are feeling very unsafe. And we need to actually take notice of that and listen to the people on the ground and hear what they're saying.
Police have said that they have the situation under control. They're confident that the criminal activity in the region is under control. They've said they're dealing with it assertively and deployed extra police to Te Rāwhiti and the Hawke's Bay. So why do you think that the military, the New Zealand Defence Force, is needed to step in?
Yeah, I mean, the police are doing a fantastic job, the ones that are there. Please don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the police aren't doing a fantastic job. What I am saying is that the communities are saying they are feeling unsafe. The communities were saying that they're having to set up their own roadblocks because people were coming into their towns and making them feel unsafe. There is a special section within the Act, Section 9, which would allow the Defence Force to come in and just back up the police. They wouldn't be under their own direction, they'd be under the direction of the police, and they would just be helping out, making sure that the community feels safe. And I really can't see why this is such a problem and why we cannot do it.
The National Party has called for penalties for theft and burglary in areas where a state of emergency has been declared to be double. Is this something that you would support?
Oh, I think we really do have to look at if a crime is committed during a state of emergency, whether that should be taken into account when it comes to sentencing. And I think that is something that should be looked at. I mean, people are going through the worst of the worst at the moment. Some people have lost absolutely everything. And if someone's willing to walk into their home and take what they have left, I really do think that that should be a consideration when coming up for sentencing.
There has been this increase in incidents of family harm as well, and organisations like Women's Refuge says that this isn't surprising and that women are often vulnerable during events like this. So what would the ACT Party do to address this issue?
Yeah, so I mean, it's really sad, and people are heightened stress, like you've said, but there's no excuse for hurting a family member. There's absolutely no excuse, and it does need to be called out for what it is. We need to have these tough conversations, and we need to be telling people that this is unacceptable, and there's absolutely no excuse for hurting a family member or harming a family member. And we need to make sure that people that are doing this are held to account, and that there are enough places for these the people who are the victims to go to for support.
That was ACT's Karen Chaw speaking on the petition to amend the disability accessibility legislation that's been through Parliament, and claims of increased crime in cyclone-affected Hawke's Bay and Tairawhiti.
That was our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chaw.
And we'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat.
Put on an event during one of AUSA's themed weeks and they'll pay for everything. Pride Week is kicking off on April 3rd, so if you have a great idea for a gay old time, then hit them up. Just make sure it's free for all students, targeted at least 50 people, and it's queer as hell. Submissions are due on March 8th. Just fill out the proposal on the last page of the tender booklet or email engagementvp@ausa.org.nz. Performing in New Zealand for the first time in 5 years, Lord. Live at the Outer Fields at Western Springs, March 4th. The long-awaited tour. From pure heroin to melodrama to solar power.
Though we're fine with this, we didn't come for money.
Don't miss Lord.
With special guests Marlon Williams, Phaser Days and Ricky Reid.
March 4th at the Outer Fields at Western Springs. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster.
Kurt Vile. You know, early 40s, long hair, cute nose, always playing the guitar. Yeah. Well, he's coming to play that guitar at the Town Hall, and we're giving away tickets. So, just get your B-card number and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive for your cue to enter. 95BFM presents Kurt Vile, live at the Auckland Town Hall, March 23rd. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
Welcome back to The Wire. You're listening to 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395.
The endless parade of time. Who can say what fruits the future will see ripen? We can only keep looking towards
tomorrow's world with Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins on 95BFM.
Welcome back to Tomorrow's World, the Wire segment where we chat science, society and the future. This week we're talking with environmental scientist Elliot Stevens about river management and slash control. Now, following the recent cyclone, it's likely you've seen images of forest waste spread over flood areas in Gisborne and Hawke's Bay. This is better known as slash. Now, council have confirmed that this has killed livestock and wildlife. It is normally stored in bird nest piles, and in the Resource Management Act, there are recommendations for slash traps. But who's really accountable? Is this a new issue? And how did it get there? Elliot gives us an insight on all of these questions. Before we get into the interview, it's important to note that at the time of recording this episode, the Forestry Minister, Stuart Nash, and Environmental Minister, David Parker, have announced a ministerial inquiry to look at the damage caused by woody debris, including slash and sediment-related damage.
So my name's Elliot Stevens, and I recently completed my master's research, and I was looking at catchment management broadly. And more specifically, looking at how river stories can support and sort of inform catchment management plans to make them sort of a more, I guess, holistic and catchment-centric plan rather than what they are at the moment. Doing my research on the Waimata River, which is down in Gisborne. Now, a lot more people are aware of the plight of the east coast of the North Island and sort of a lot of the issues that they're facing and have been facing for a long time. Research sort of unearthed that, you know, there's a lot of values and mindsets because at the end of the day, these people are in the catchment every day. They either live there, work there, or use it for their recreation.
You could explain, I guess, the idea of catchment management and bringing people together.
So, I mean, catchment management's been around a long time and it does hold a lot of value. But I think maybe it's a product of like the capacities of the people sort of actioning these plans, and also, I guess, policies that are set at a national level, there's a lot of things that aren't captured. So, for example, in Gisborne, you know, you've got the district council, but they're looking after the whole of the East Cape. And so there's, I guess, constraints there. And so they've got some things that they have to fulfill under the Resource Management Act. Three Waters will come into it a little bit. What I'm trying to, or I have tried to show, was that it's not necessarily like a council-centric approach. Like, it needs to be more inclusive of communities. And actually that they do bring a lot of value to it and can sort of increase that capacity.
And I think when, you know, we've just gone through the floods and people think, oh, how did it get to this? Surely people are aware that maybe areas are flood prone, or what were systems in place, why the management perhaps led to what we did see.
In Gisborne, you can sort of draw a line back to Cyclone Bola, which was kind of before the last few we've had. Was like the real big event, and there was a lot of erosion following that event as well. And so we had catchments that were getting planted and as erosion mitigation measures, and there's a lot of pine trees, and so we have inherently ended up with a lot of catchments that have a lot of pine trees. And what you do with those pine trees is obviously up to the landowner, and so some of them will chop them down and sell them as timber, and more recently you've got carbon farming. And so it was, for a long time, it was seen, well, it was the solution. And I guess now we are seeing, well, Gisborne has seen it for a while, you know, when these trees are getting chopped down, you are still getting flow-on effects. And so I guess that's something that needs to start coming to catchment plans a bit more. I'm not saying it isn't in there now, but maybe we need to have a wider look at the impacts on people and sort of what the different compartments of society are being impacted by these things. And don't get me wrong, I think forestry has a place, but we need to find the right place for it.
You know, that forestry is a fantastic resource, things we use in everyday life, but exactly, it's challenging that status quo of, oh, this is how forestry works, or this is the most efficient way to perhaps, you know, go through and do a harvest or leave slash. And then we now see those consequences, and it's an opportunity to actually perhaps reframe it or put in those policies or mitigations so that doesn't happen again. I guess people have heard the word slash thrown around in the media in the last couple of weeks, and perhaps it's not directly at your research. I guess, what is it?
Yeah, and I think it was definitely raised in the research. You know, forestry slash is a key concern for communities all along that coast. But to answer your question, slash, put simply, is sort of like the leftover bits after, or during and after forestry harvest. So you've got, you know, your roots, and you've got like broken branches, broken trunks, sort of the stuff that they can't conceivably sell. Yeah, I guess maybe finding a market for those in some way would help. Hopefully the forestry inquiry raises some good points, and sort of everyone's able to have their say on it, I think, because the last thing you want is to have the inquiry and then only, you know, select people are able to partake. And as I said, like, my research unearthed a lot of information that would be valuable to them.
What were some of the discussions around slash?
Yeah, and I mean, the slash for the communities and the people that I spoke with was not a new issue, and so they've always had a concern for it, and obviously it affects their livelihoods and it affects, you know, their way of life.
I guess the segment that we do with Tomorrow's World, it's looking at often issues that have become topical, but then imagining in the future. And like you said, it is complex, and perhaps it's not just one answer, but where do you imagine this going, or where do we need to transition where these issues perhaps don't keep reoccurring, or we're aware of them and we can be prepared for them?
I think it comes back to my comment before about getting enough people around the table to talk about it. I don't think it's going to be a quick fix. It's not going to look the same for every catchment. You know, there's avenues to get rid of the slash, and I think maybe that needs to be a discussion before we harvest. So we need to be thinking about what's going to happen afterwards. And so, like, linking back to your comment about Tomorrow's World, I think we do need to be having those forward-looking, sort of looking at trajectories.
There's ideas, you know, of, yeah, slash traps, or perhaps you said you could find other avenues for it, or some sort of industry use. Do you think it will need that policy at the top to make the change?
Yeah, I think there is going to be some sort of impetus at the top that says, okay, no, we actually do need to make changes, and you're bound to make the change. But I think equally, bottom-up approaches are going to be helpful in finding solutions.
I guess maybe to summarise, but also to go back to your research, you've had lots of interesting findings from it. What are perhaps to you some of the really key interesting points from it?
One of the things that I really enjoyed and probably got stuck into is like the unique histories of each catchment. So the Waimata is steeped in history, and people still live that history today, and they take great satisfaction out of, you know, certain things being still in their original form. And also, I guess, until you go and immerse yourself in these communities, you don't realize how much these rivers mean to people. Just having these green and blue spaces is immensely powerful. Every community sort of deserves to have access to these places.
Now, that's all we have time for today, but what an insightful conversation, and hopefully we see real action come from the inquiry due in April.
Looks like everything's going to be all right.
Tomorrow's World with Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins on 95 BFM.
In times of crisis, arts, culture and creative experiences play an essential role. According to James Wenley, lecturer at the theatre programme at Victoria University of Wellington, the arts and culture in New Zealand are in their own cycle of crisis. Why are we in this cycle and how do we break out of it?
So it's a cycle of crisis because arts and culture tends to be not valued to the extent that actually it positively contributes to people's well-being and lives. So we're in a cycle where wages remain low, where there's not enough funding and resources that's put into arts, culture and creativity. And it's often when you're looking for savings, one of the first things that is cut. So at the moment, Auckland Council are proposing some cuts that would really majorly affect the number of sorts of cultural events that happen around the city, things like the Lantern Festival, Diwali Festival. So we need to get out of this cycle, and it's been especially bad through COVID-19. The pandemic's been really, really tough on the sector. We've seen so many cancellations over the past few years. So we're very much in a rebuilding mode at the moment, and we need to see greater valuing and resources put into Aotearoa's arts and culture sector.
Why are we in this cycle, do you think? Could you give maybe some historical context of how we ended up here?
Sure. Well, I think it does go back to money. One of the major ways that the government gets money out into the sector is through the Ministry for Culture and Heritage and the arts funding agency Creative New Zealand. That was formed in the 2000s, and many of the New Zealand books that we read, performing arts that get up, a lot of that is funded by Creative New Zealand. But the major problem is that a lot of their funding isn't actually from taxpayer money. It's from lotteries, so all the lotto tickets that are sold in New Zealand, some of those go to sporting organisations, community organisations and the arts. So Creative New Zealand's income can fluctuate from year to year, and historically it's been starved of funding. So if you go back to around 2008 and the amount of money that Creative New Zealand was receiving from the government at that time and baseline funding, that actually hasn't really grown substantially at all through all the years later. So you just aren't getting the proper resourcing. As New Zealand's population grows, you would be expecting the funding to increase, but that just hasn't been happening. And we have had some good support through COVID, that there has been some money put out there by the government to just keep us afloat, but all of that money is going to be spent very soon. So there's a big question of, well, what comes next? And we really need some long-term thinking and strategy that properly values arts and culture as something that can really benefit so many New Zealanders.
True, you argue that we need a better national arts and culture policy. Could you describe maybe how this would look like? What would your ideal policy on a national level look like?
Yeah, so this I think is the next big thing that needs to happen for New Zealand. It's really interesting because the Australian government, they've just introduced the Revive National Cultural Policy, And they say that's about putting arts back at the centre of national life in Australia. So they've done a review with the sector. They've come up with a range of really interesting policies and the money to back it up to actually get it in place. So it's things like more money for the regions in Australia. They've even got interesting things like having quotas with streaming services, so more Australian stories are being told in different platforms. So we should also be thinking about what could a New Zealand version of that look like, particularly, I think, drawing upon the insights from Te Ao Māori and Ngā Toi, which is very much, it's a way of thinking about arts and cultural expression as really intrinsic to who you are as a human. It's really, really important. So what I would love for a national policy is to look at where resources could be best put in terms of making the most impact. Looking at arts programs that intersect with education, that intersect with the justice system, there's many programs that can really transform people's lives. So if you are thinking about the arts, it's not just something that you go to and attend, but something that everyone can participate in. I think I'd really love to see an arts and cultural policy that really makes that a bottom line, that as many New Zealanders as possible can meaningfully participate in artistic and creative activities.
Could you give an example of that?
One of the things I think about is some arts programs in prison. There's a really, really powerful one called Homeground, which works with wahine in prison, and to kind of have that platform, place to express yourself is really powerful. So it's things like that that I think there's real potential for arts and culture to meaningfully change people's lives. And so if you support that and value that right from the top of government, there's so many areas of society that could benefit from a more sustainable and focused approach to supporting arts and culture and creativity.
Yeah, do you think the New Zealand government will do that, and how can we make them do that?
Well, at the moment, the Minister for Arts and Culture Heritage, Minister Cipollone, has said that they're not currently looking at a national arts and culture policy. The interesting thing is that the Ministry for Culture and Heritage, they've got a briefing document which does recognise actually having something in place would be really, really helpful for the ecosystem, that we're thinking about this as a big kind of joined up thing rather than little isolated pockets, different organisations, different art forms. So that advice is there, that this would be really beneficial. So whether this will happen, I think this does need to be, you know, on the table in terms of the political debates this year. We are thinking about the physical infrastructure that needs to be rebuilt coming off the really devastating weather events of the past month. But I think within that, we also need to be thinking about like our cultural and social infrastructure that we need to strengthen and build that as well. And so arts and culture has a really important role to play, I think, in making New Zealand an even better place to live and a place where there's many activities and things that people can enjoy.
That was James Wenley, lecturer at the theatre programme at Victoria University of Wellington.
Speaking to Takutai Kemp, the party's candidate for Tamaki Makaurau, I talked to her about the reason for having a Māori party in the first place, the party's exclusion from tomorrow's general election debate on campus, Three Waters and Te Matatini. I started by asking her about the party's kaupapa.
Kia ora. So the kaupapa for Te Pāti Māori is that it's all about assertion of our mana motuhake and our liberation, that we are a Māori political movement. We don't really call ourselves a party, but a political movement, and that we're guided by our own tikanga, and we fiercely advocate for the best interests of our whānau, hapū and iwi. So how I see it is, it's all about whānau. You know, it's all about upholding the best interests of our people. It's always about being guided by our tikanga that we're surrounded by, and it's about keeping our tikanga and our principles alive.
And just for our listeners who may not be familiar, what is Mana Motu Hake?
When I think about Mana Motu Hake, I think about it's about Māori being in control, Māori being able to be ourselves, to be able to live the life that we want to be able to live. And that's how I look at Mana Motu Hake, having the freedom to be Māori and to do the things that we do.
And why have a particular Māori party instead of just running in the Māori seats with the other major parties?
Well, when we look at Te Pāti Māori and the movement, we want to be able to ensure that, well, we are, you know, tiriti focused, and that's what we base ourselves on, and that we are the only indigenous movement or party and government led by Māori for Māori with Māori.
So there's an election debate tomorrow at the University of Auckland. There's representatives from various parties, but I haven't seen any representative for Te Pāti Māori announced. Why is Te Pāti Māori not represented at this debate?
Well, that's actually a very good question, and that's probably something for the uni. Maybe they haven't put that out to the party, and this is only my own opinion, and that I'm actually unsure why there is. There should always be a representative from Te Pāti Māori at such crucial debates, especially when we want to talk the rangatahi, especially when it's here in Tamaki Makaurau.
Do debates miss out from not having that Māori perspective brought to them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from an Indigenous perspective and from a Māori perspective, you miss that there will be, you know, you will miss definitely having a voice at that tepu.
So there was a recent High Court decision rejecting some local councils' bid seeking to vindicate their property rights over infrastructure assets, and specifically water infrastructure assets. I guess just why so much controversy over what's an infrastructure bill? You know, it's quite boring, but it's become the centre of a culture war almost.
When I think about the infrastructure, you know, we think about what is best for our whenua, what is best for our tangata, for our people, and sometimes they don't always do what's best. And that's why we have some of these problems that are happening around Tamaki Makaurau, with the warm, you know, with a lot of the weather that's happening, with the flooding. Part of that is the infrastructure isn't able to cope. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we, that, you know, we can't answer for council. And we want to just make sure that Māori have a voice when it comes to three waters, and that we are upholding that kaupapa.
And I saw that Te Pāti Māori actually voted against the bill in its final reading, seeing as Te Pāti Māori voted against this because it doesn't go far enough in recognising rangatiratanga over water assets. And on the other end of the spectrum, you've just got a complete rejection of any Māori input into governance over water infrastructure. Does that make co-governance actually the compromise position instead of this sort of extreme radical position?
Well, we would probably say it, you know, again, my opinion, we don't believe and support in co-governance because we believe we own the water. Well, it's our rights. Have access to water. So that's an Indigenous stance for Three Waters. But it's not a kōrero that I can elaborate more on because I'm not the MP for the party.
And this week Te Pāti Māori has had quite a big presence at Te Matatini, right?
It's been a great week to be Māori. Proud to be Māori has been everywhere here in Tamaki Makaurau with Te Matatini. You know, we've just come out of a great week of recognition, a week of celebration, a week of acknowledgement around being proud to be Māori, and we saw that here in Tamaki Makaurau. And as a people at the moment, that is what we were focused on over the last week.
You know, we can put the three waters, the council, and all of those things to the side over the last week where we've come together as a nation, as whānau hapū iwi, to celebrate who we are as a people and who we are as Māori. And to us in the last week, that's been our focus. And here in Tamaki Makaurau at Eden Park. And I think that should be something that we acknowledge. We acknowledge all those kapa haka rōpū who took to the stage. We acknowledge those groups that came from Gisborne, from Te Tai Rāwhiti, from Ngāti Kahununu, from Hastings Napier, Ahuriri, who came, you know, in a time where they didn't want to leave their whenua, where they didn't want to leave their whānau due to the flooding. And they came to Tamaki Makaurau to represent their whānau hapū. And we acknowledge them for doing that and to come. We heard their mamai, we felt it, but we also felt their aroha for their people. And it's a time where we have to remind our people we can rise up and things are going to be okay. It's going to be a long recovery, you know, for those communities, for those iwi, before we can move past this, but we will be okay as a people. And that's what I'd like to focus on as we think about the past week with Te Matatini. And to mihi to the winners, to Te Whānau Aapanui and the haka group of our MP, Rauri Waititi, who announced him on the stage as a running candidate again for Wairākei. So a big mihi to Rauri for continuing his journey and for his kapa haka rōpū, Te Whānau Aapanui. I think sometimes we get wrapped up in that, you know, the policy, the Pākehā mainstream kaupapa that is out and around us, but this week we acknowledge those whānau that have been affected by the flooding, by Cyclone Gabriel, and for those whānau that were here that took the stage at Te Matatini.
And I guess there's a political vision that does lie in this sort of gathering of community, right?
Look, definitely. And if, I'm not sure if you managed to get there, but what a beautiful place to be, to feel the wairua, to feel the aroha of our whānau, but to hear what it is that our kapa haka groups are talking about, are singing about, having haka about, you know, talking about the political agendas, talking about the changes that our people want to see, talking about leaders, and that's what we heard on the stage. But what Te Matatini brought us was connection. It brought us together as a people. We haven't been able to be part of Te Matatini for the last 4 years due to COVID. And really proud of our people and proud of the Te Matatini Association for carrying on and showing up people the resilience. And there's always a political stance in all those types of things because that's what we do. That's what we do with kapa haka. We share our thoughts, our whakaaro, our feelings of what's happening around us.
That was Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp speaking about Manamata Hake being left out from an upcoming election debate, Three Waters, and circling back to Manamata Hake through community in Te Matatini.
We'll be back right after a short break. Keep it on the bay.
My dog. dealing with my own biz. How'd they get my name and number? Then I stop and think and wonder about a plan. Yo, man, I gotta step out time. You wanna call me up? Take my number down. It's 2222222. I got an answer machine that can talk to you. It goes,
hey, how you doing? Sorry, I can't get through, but leave your name and the number, and I'll get back to you. Yo, check it. Exit the old style, into the new. But nothing's new by being hawked by me. Or should I say a flock? Cause around every block there's Harry, Dick, and Tom with a demo in his palm. Now I'm with helping those who want to help themselves and flaunt a nut that's doggy as a dog. But it's not the move to hear the tales of limousines and pails of money they'll make like a pro. I be like, yo, black is claiming a tape. Well, I have to show the time is fair, I just make. But the songs created in they shacks be so wick, wick, whack. Situations like this, I now hate to give me smiles. Kool-Aid wide and ass. And with the straightest face, I be like, hell yes. I list them the digits of Papa Prince Paul, so I don't go AWOL. But yet I know when they call, they get.
Hey, how you doing? Sorry you can't get through. Why don't you leave me and your number, and I'll get back to you. Hey, how are you doing? Sorry you can't get through. Why don't you leave your name and your number, and I'll get back to you. Check it out. Party at the Dragon on Dixon Ave. Haven't been to a jam in quite a while. Piles of them it takes by the miles. All I wanna do is count on the deck. Proud brother dishing the fear by the mile to the sector. Believer of duty, plug one most thing, and I be like, yo, G Pasta's all the producer.
Now woe is me to the third degree. Maze pulls the funny, so I make like the bunny. Jet, but I'm getting used to this demo abuse. Getting raped and giving birth to a tape. Cause there's no escape from the clutches of a hawker. Attached to my success, sent like a stalker. Make way to my radius, playing fly guy. Try to get my back, they force like Luke Scott. Me, myself, and I go to this act daily. And rarely do I not. No matter how I dodge, some jackal always nails me. No matter what the plot. And even out on tour, they be like, yo, I gotta get the player back at the hotel. I be like, oh, swell, unveil the numeric code that guides my room. And tell them to call me at noon. But of course, there's no answering machine in my room. But a pretty young girl who I swung on tour. And if it rings while we're alone, she'll answer the phone. And with the weakness, she'll recite like a poem.
Hey, you done did the right thing, dollar. My ring ring, now you're waiting on the beat. Say, I would love if you sing a tune the true instead of frontin' on the street. So no problemo, just play your demo. And at the end, it's breakout time. Please, oh please, don't press rewind, cause I'll just lay it down the line. Hey, how you doing? Sorry you can't get through. Why don't you leave your name and your number, and I'll get back to you.
Hey, how you doing? Sorry you can't get through. Why don't you leave your name and your number, and we'll get back to you.
After last year's forced cancellation, AUSA is bringing Auckland Uni orientation back to its rightful home, Alfred Street.
They've curated a festival that shows off UOA's favourite little lane. And best of all, it's free. That's right, no ticket needed to party at Alfred's.
With food trucks, arcades, giveaways and live performances from Wax Mustang, Juju Lips, Messiah and more, Alfred Street is the place to be for University of Auckland Orientation 2023, February 27th to March 1st.
Check out AUSA online for more.
Put on an event during one of AUSA's themed weeks and they'll pay for everything. International Week kicks off May 8th, so this is your cue to get cultural. Just make sure that your event is free for all students, targeted at least 50 people, and deep into the heritage, customs and food of Auckland Uni's diverse campus. Submissions are due March 8th. Just fill out the proposal on the last page of the tender booklet or email engagementvp@ausa.org.nz.
Kurt Vile. You know, early 40s, long hair, cute nose, always playing the guitar. Yeah. Well, he's coming to play that guitar at the Town Hall, and we're giving away tickets. So, just give your B-card number and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive for your cue to enter. 95BFM presents Kurt Vile, live at the Auckland Town Hall, March 23rd. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
Welcome back to The Wire. You're listening to 95BFM, and we're joined in the studio with Callum from Renews. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Lovely to be here.
That's good. And can you tell us a bit about yourself and what you're doing with Renews?
Yeah, so I'm the digital and social producer, which is it's weird to be like now in print and radio. It's actually really nice. It's much more tangible. But I kind of work behind the scenes doing publishing, marketing, bit of like data science stuff, which is lots of fun. And we're here just to talk to some students this week, get the kind of vibe of what's going on and give away some free shirts.
Yeah, for sure. So you're down at O Week. Can you tell us a bit about what you've been getting up to, what you've been chatting about?
Yeah. So, the kind of crux of our campaign this week is we launched a new kind of campaign with Yeehaw the Boys, Dan Vernon from Darts fame, and he did these insane election WWE-style things of all the different kind of major and minor party candidates. We printed them out, put them on T-shirts, and now we're down here talking to students about kind of what they think needs to be on the election ballot, what they need to be talking about, what they're thinking of, whether they've voted before, because there's a lot of freshers, or whether this is locked in.
And with young voters sort of thinking about the election, what was their kind of response to you asking about that? Were they aware it was happening? Were they thinking about it already? What were their kind of thoughts and feelings about it?
Yeah, I was surprised at how much people wanted to come up to us and have a yarn. They was like, oh, if you want a shirt, you have to come and talk to us. They were like, oh, yeah, I'm ready, let's go. And the main things that they were talking about was essentially two issues of climate change and the cost of living crisis. The cost of living crisis, especially, I think it's most felt always in student communities and then also, you know, minority communities, LGBTQ communities. And they were really present on, like, it's just not a pleasant sight to be working in a supermarket and seeing that people can't have to put things back, have to be really watching the budget, and they don't know whether any party is going to really solve that issue.
And yeah, students will definitely be experiencing a lot of those issues firsthand, but there is sort of a low voter turnout that's been quite dismally low recently. So what do you think, or what have students been saying might be deterring them from engaging in politics?
I think a lot of it came down to the kind of the information they're receiving. A couple of people, I just didn't even know what it was. It seemed like a big 2-month window period. And whether that's, you know, if someone says that, whether there was a clear date or not, it usually means that the message didn't get through to them and there's a lot of noise around the signal. So I usually think that the more you can advertise, it has to take not just the election organization campaign, and it takes media outlets that are targeting those young folks. It really is a wide-ranging kind of activity to get those people engaged.
For sure. And the people that you did speak to, were they already decided on who they're going to vote for, sort of what is going to drive them to vote, or are they kind of a bit more like up in the air, we'll kind of see what the policies that come out are? Are they sort of a bit more uncertain?
Yeah, it was really up in the air. A lot of people, there was a lot of different matrices of people being like, I want a socialist Nats Green government, which I thought was a very interesting combo. And then you have kind of people that are like, no, I'm definitely Greens, or I'm going for Labour. I don't, you know, mind that Jacinda has stepped down. I still want that kind of just left of centre. But a lot of people just don't know what the answer is. Like, what party can really step up when I ask them what they want to hear from those people? They're like, a bit of a surety, a bit of kind of reassurance that something is going to be done about the climate, and just have some actual proactive movement, whether that's carbon tax, Paris agreements, the really small stuff, but especially with Cyclone Gabrielle, it's really at the front of a lot of students' minds.
Yeah, and what do people think about our new Prime Minister? Has anyone shared thoughts on that, and whether they prefer Hipkins to Ardern, or any thoughts around that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people were just sad to see her go. I think they understood the reasons behind it, the misogyny, the pressure, and kind of the changing tide of what Labour is able to represent. A lot of people, one person was really disappointed that they didn't get many of the promises that they'd voted for in that last election, 2020, because they came in with such a clear mandate. But I think a lot of people are still pretty keen on Hipkins over Luxon.
And if people are keen to come and have a chat with you, or check out any of your stuff or your election coverage, where can we find you on campus and where can we find you online, I guess?
Yeah, well, we're down just right on, is it Alfred Street?
Alfred Street, yes.
that's the place we're hanging out. You can get a free T-shirt. We've got only 100 left and we've split it between our Victoria Uni campus and Auckland, so there's only 50 to go around. But online, you can find us at RenewsNZ, RENEWSNZ, TikTok, YouTube, Instagram. Wherever you get your news, come find us. We'll give you some cool infographics or something.
Sweet. Thanks so much, Callum.
Appreciate it.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa, mō tēnei wiki ni te mihi ki a koutou katoa, e kōrero, mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The Wonderful with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.